This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Today we're interviewing Karen Garthwaite. She's the acting public affairs specialist for Canyonlands and has been an interpretation park ranger with the Park Service since 2004, and she's been here in Moabs for 18 years. Canyonlands National Park is in southeastern Utah. It was established in 1964 and preserves over 500 square miles of high desert country through which flow the Green and Colorado rivers. So welcome, Karen. It's great to be talking with you.
Likewise, thanks.
What's going on down in southern Utah? So tell us about the natural history of Canyonlands. High plains, deep river channels. How was Canyonlands formed?
Well, right there in the name. You know that canyons comprise the center of the park, and it is a rock-based park, right? All the rock layers you see in Canyonlands are sedimentary, deposited over millions of years of changing environments. We got sand dune deserts, braided rivers, ancient seas. All of those environments left their dirt behind, compressed, lithified, and then thanks to the uplift of the Colorado Plateau about 60 million years ago, all that rock became vulnerable to erosion. And that is really where the story of Canyonlands starts. The cumulative impact of water, wind, gravity, and time just chewing away at those rocks. Obviously, the rivers have played a role in sculpting the canyons, but honestly, it's the winter ice freezing in the crevices, tearing the rocks apart, every summer thunderstorm. Each action further sculpts this landscape into just this wilderness of rock.
So down at river level, how old are the rocks?
Now, you didn't tell me you were going to ask that question. I don't have my numbers at hand.
That's right.
Hold on, I can get them.
So do you have some fossils there in the park?
There are fossils in the park. Now, of course, when you're dealing with a sand dune desert environment, that's a challenging environment for capturing and preserving fossils. But they do exist. We do have trace fossils in some abundance, especially in mud layers, places that were, you know, braided streams and such. Visitors with a really keen eye walking around might be able to see the occasional dinosaur track or lizard track, or even, gosh, I've heard we even have some fish belly marks in one place, but that's not the main reason that people come to the park.
So there are dinosaur fossils.
There are, yeah. This whole region, some people refer to as like the dinosaur diamond, this region of southeastern Utah, actually going clear up pretty far north, even outside the state. And a name like that tells you, like, the landscape here does have fossil record in it. That's not something that is easy for visitors to see at Canyonlands, though. We don't have any features that are, you know, marked on the map, per se. And I do have my numbers here again if you want to ask that question again.
Well,
the ages of rocks.
When I asked about dinosaurs, I was thinking they were wiped out 65 million years ago. So apparently at river level, it's older than that.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. So the inner canyon of the Green and Colorado Rivers, we're way back in mid-Pennsylvania. So about, you know, 300 million years ago. That predates dinosaurs.
Oh, yeah.
By a good margin, yeah. But the rock layers that are most evident for the majority of Canyonlands visitors, what they're hiking around more in the Triassic, Jurassic, sandstones, and those formations.
I see.
Where we do have some things, you know, like petrified wood, as well as some other fossil evidence.
Is there much archaeological work that goes on in the park?
Absolutely. The area that's now known as Canyonlands National Park has been inhabited or traveled through by multiple indigenous cultures for thousands and thousands of years. And evidence of their presence is all around us, although a lot of it is pretty subtle. It might just be a place where someone sat and made a stone tool and left some of those lithic scatters on the ground. We do have pictographs, petroglyphs, some stone and earthen dwellings or other structures just scattered across that 500 square mile landscape. Actually, I should mention that two parts of the park have such an abundance of cultural sites. They're listed on the National Register of Historic Places.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is the Salt Creek Archaeological District. That's in the south section of the park called the Needles, that has just superb stone and mortar structures, kind of like a Mesa Verdean era. And then also the Horseshoe Canyon Archaeological District, which is managed by the Mays over on the west side of the park, has absolutely astounding pictographs. Some of them over 8 feet tall. Some of them have estimated ages of 2,000 to 4,000 years old.
Mm.
And it's just astounding that they've been able to withstand time. And it's a very powerful place.
Is there evidence of habitation in the prehistoric period by the indigenous people, or were they just traveling through?
I'm going to have to say yes, both. Because we are dealing with clear back to 10,000 years, multiple cultures have passed through, and different cultures have different life ways, right? So we certainly have evidence of lots of hunter-gatherer type of activity, small groups moving across the land. But there's also evidence of farming at different times. The classic Three Sisters farming, right? Corn, beans, and squash in a number of different places, wherever there's naturally available water. Now, of course, it's a desert, so water is not abundant for us. But any place where there are natural springs or seeps or even along river bottoms, those places do show evidence of farming going back quite a long time.
Is there evidence of climate change? Was the climate different back in the prehistoric period?
There is evidence of changing climates. Of course, we're talking a very different rate of change back then versus what scientists are documenting now. You know, we could get into that if you'd like. But yes, going back a number of thousands of years, there's definitely evidence that what's now Canyonlands was cooler and wetter. In fact, this is kind of neat. We do have a residual population of Douglas fir trees, believe it or not, surviving in some north-facing alcoves of the northern district of the park. That's up at 6,000 feet elevation. So it's relatively cool up there. But there is archaeological evidence that things like Douglas fir and other vegetation species that need a cooler, wetter habitat were more abundant back, 5,000 years ago. Then there is evidence of a drying out and a warming up, which certainly impacted people's life ways and where they had to travel and what foodstuffs they were able to get.
Well, back in the 19th century, John Wesley Powell traveled down the river. I think he put in on the Green River and then traveled down and met the Colorado. So was he the one who did he discover it, or did he hear about it and then want to explore it?
So first I just have to acknowledge, discovery is a term that we generally try to avoid using because it does negate the presence
and
knowledge of the indigenous people who were already here. But I know what you mean. I just needed to acknowledge that.
Right.
There is definitely evidence of other early European descendant explorers. For a lot of them, the Mays of these canyons probably seemed impenetrable, although there were indigenous footpaths going through this landscape that then settlers and traders were using. Probably beaver trappers were coming through, beaver and otter in the early 19th century. One of the earliest dates I know actually was a scientific expedition in 1859 that documented seeing the pinnacles that we call the needles of that southern district of Canyonlands. But then, of course, John Wesley Powell absolutely came through, and he is arguably the most famous explorer of that era of this region.
What years did he travel?
So his first expedition was in 1869, and you're correct, they put in at Green River, Wyoming, and didn't come out until they cleared the Grand Canyon in Arizona. It was a very fraught expedition. an astounding one, of course. He was a one-armed Civil War veteran in wooden dories, and they were doing all the science that they could, but they also ran into some obstacles for which they were just not prepared. And he documented the trip very thoroughly and then repeated the journey in 1871, 1872, and redid a lot of the mapping effort at that point. And then what he ended up publishing in 1895 with the title The Exploration of the Colorado and Its Canyons, well, that's kind of an amalgamation of the two trips, as I understand it, but it does have some very colorful quotes that really describe this area. If you don't mind, I'd like to share this one. The landscape everywhere away from the river is of rock. Cliffs of rock, plateaus of rock, terraces of rock, crags of rock, 10,000 strangely carved forms. No one writes like that anymore.
Did he encounter any indigenous people going through?
He absolutely did. In fact, we have come across some photographs of John Wesley Powell meeting with some Paiute elders, probably not within the stretch that is now Canyonlands. That was probably a bit further south. But there's actually quite a story there that it was his encounters with the indigenous as he was traveling through the West that really did shape the rest of his life. He spent some time after he finished this effort with the USGS. He started documenting life on reservation lands, and that was really his focus for the rest of his life. So, pretty impactful encounters.
Has there been any mining taking place within the area of Canyonlands?
Yes. Prior to the establishment of the national park, the area was actually used for grazing and ranching first, from the 1880s clear up until, well, technically the 1970s. A little bit of ranching was still happening after the park was established, but that was for, sheep and cattle, grazing. There are fantastic grasslands up on some of these plateaus. But I'm sorry, you asked about mining. So yeah, the mining really kicked off more in the 1950s, during that era where folks were wrapped up in the atomic age excitement, right?
Looking for uranium.
Was found here, exactly. Yeah. And Moab became an overnight uranium boom town.
Wow.
More people lived in Moab during that era then live here today, which is pretty astounding because they did not have the infrastructure or the paved roads or the schools or the traffic lights, right? but yeah, so there are a number of mine adits sprinkled around on this one layer in the northern district, mostly, of Canyonlands National Park. None of them yielded anything, but the routes that the prospectors were taking in their old, surplus World War II Jeeps, I imagine, just bumpity-bumpity-bumping, out in the rock landscape. Those paths and trails are still evident today.
Mm.
because of the nature of the soils out here, when you impact them like that, when you bust through this living soil cover that we have, it takes a very long time to recover. So from a number of viewpoints in the park, you can look down and see some of these old roadways and trace them with your eye, and sometimes you'll see a little hole in the rock where somebody went looking, but thankfully nothing ever yielded a big productive mine. But instead, those guys probably went home and talked about this really cool place they were driving and how beautiful it was. And I think there's a direct line between that era of exploration in the 1950s and then Canyonlands becoming a national park in 1964, once people had gotten out in the land and discovered its beauty.
So what are the outstanding features in Canyonlands?
Oh, gosh, we only have half an hour to talk. It's, you know, we often get compared to the Grand Canyon, but, of course, they only have one river. We have two. So when you're on the in the northern section of Canyonlands, the rivers form kind of like a Y that cuts through the whole park. So the northern section, you do have a river on either side of you. So as you're driving out the scenic road, you've got views in both directions. Sunrise, sunset, every moment that the light is changing, it's hitting those canyons and the rocks and making absolutely different shapes and colors out on the land. That northern district you can see for 40, 50 miles in all directions, far outside of the park boundary. But of course, this whole region is scenic. It's not only pretty inside the national park here. Once you get down into the canyons, then you have that surrounded by rock feeling where you can really see those sculptural shapes up close. The southern district, the Needles, I've heard described like a rock sculpture park. I mean, toadstools, arches, buttes, mesas, towers, you name it. If you can sculpt it out of rock, you can hike to it, and in some cases through it in the park.
Are there any areas in the park that are designated as wilderness?
I don't believe we have any officially designated wilderness, but we do have hundreds of square miles of recommended wilderness. So that effort was done early in the park's history of documenting and proposing and then signing off as recommended wilderness, which means the park manages it as wilderness while we are waiting for the official legislative designation. So it amounts to the same thing in terms of how the park is managed.
So there's a lot of hiking that opportunity within the park without having...
Pretty much, yeah. The way I like to phrase it is there's an adventure to be had, whatever your adventure level is. You know, for some people, just driving to get out here is the adventure because we're not really close to any major cities. Yeah. We're about 4 hours from Salt Lake City, Utah, about 6 hours from Denver, Colorado. So it takes a bit to get here. So just driving the scenic roads, that might be adventurous for some folks. We do have some amazing mountain biking on our unpaved roads. There's one route that wraps around the northern district of the park that can make about a 100-mile circuit. And for mountain biking, it's just incredible. It's typically a multi-day thing. You're camping out in the backcountry in between your days of pedaling, but you are pedaling through the most astounding quiet that can be imagined. And when you're camping at night, those designated campsites are by permit only, and you might be 5 miles away from the next campers.
And horses are allowed?
Like you're out there. Pardon me?
Horses are allowed in the park?
Horses are allowed in the park, but there are some stipulations about being on weed and seed-free feed for a certain length of time before entering the park, and they're not permitted everywhere. So that's, you know, if you want to bring horses in, it's always a good idea to call the park to get all those details ahead of time.
And are there restrictions on mountain bikes where they can go?
There are, definitely. Yeah, mountain bikes are only permitted where vehicles can go. Mm. So we don't have any mountain bike usage on hiking trails. And as far as vehicles, Jeeps and street legal motorcycles are permitted on those backcountry roads, but OHVs, ATVs, side-by-sides, those are not permitted inside the national park. Mm-hmm. They are allowed for use right outside the park. We're pretty much surrounded by BLM land that does have different policies. But when a lot of people come to Utah, that can be confusing at first, since OHVing is such a popular recreation activity outside the park. It's good to know where those boundaries are.
Have you noticed any consequences of climate change in the park in the last few years?
Well, the answer to that's definitely yes. Our area of the Colorado Plateau is potentially the epicenter of the warming that is happening in the lower 48. So we're definitely already seeing changes in the precipitation regime. You know, it's raining different amounts at different times of year, as well as an overall increase in temperature. And that absolutely affects everything. You know, it affects the vegetation in obvious ways. They're not getting the precipitation when they need it.
Mm-hmm.
It also means that what precipitation we do have is evaporating faster. So for species that rely on underground water, like our amazing trees, the pinyon and the Utah juniper, you know, they can have taproots 50, 75 feet long. They're tapping into deep underground water storage that might not be getting replenished the way those long-lived trees are used to.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, we are seeing things like pinyon die-off, which is exacerbated by insects, and insects that are more active because it is warmer for longer, but the drought conditions are certainly adding stress on those trees as well.
So,
and then I didn't even mention wildlife. You know, it's pretty uncertain.
Well, I think we're going to get wildlife in the second half hour. So,
yeah. I meant for climate change.
Oh, okay. Yeah. We're just about running out of time for our first interview, but is there some research that's going on in the park?
Parks are outdoor laboratories. One thing I always like mentioning, because a lot of people don't know about it, there's a whole branch of the National Park System called the Inventory and Monitoring Program.
Oh, really?
And they are scientists tasked with doing those two words, inventorying what resources are in the park, and then monitoring their ongoing health and conditions. So we do have ongoing research happening for all the parks in this region, conducted by the Northern Colorado Plateau Unit of the INM program, the Inventory and Monitoring Program. And they publish briefs all the time, fascinating stuff. We try to link to it on the park website. And then there are other research projects that are linked to, like, high-priority park management issues or efforts that are being completed by sister agencies like USGS or university partnerships, that sort of thing. And honestly, climate change response is a big focus area of a lot of that research right now.
Are there any universities that do research in the park?
There definitely are. I'm not familiar with the specific names because I'm not as involved in that branch of permitting operation.
Okay. I was going to ask you about pollution and any problems that you've got in air and water quality.
Let's see. I'll take those in turn. So Canyonlands National Park is a Class 1 airshed.
Yeah.
So that preserves special air quality and visibility, you know, protection under the Clean Air Act.
Uh-huh.
So we're grateful. We're pretty far from any major sources of air pollution,
yeah,
aside from smoke from regional wildland fires. Anytime the Southwest is burning, it will drift through here, and it can really impact the visibility at daytime, and then also impact our visibility at nighttime. Canyonlands National Park was designated an international dark sky park because of its lack of light pollution. It's usually pretty amazing at night. You can just reach up and run your fingers through the Milky Way. But when we are having one of those fire incidents nearby, that can really impact that.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of water quality, generally the water quality is good. Monitoring is done in a number of the natural seeps and springs throughout the park. Phosphorus can be high. It probably is coming from fertilizers or, you know, domestic animal or human sources or even wind deposited sources. A lot of potential on that one. The high phosphorus levels in the rivers themselves are probably coming from upstream sources like agricultural runoff. There is a sewage treatment plant for Moab that is just north of Canyonlands National Park. But, of course, they are, you know, mandated to meet certain thresholds for their effluent. So, but these are all monitoring activities that occur regularly.
Who are they treating sewage from?
Well, the town of Moab.
Oh, okay.
With our residential population of about 6,000 people and our tourism population of about 3.5 million a year.
Wow. You get that many, huh?
Actually, it might be closer to three than three and a half. But we're not a sleepy little river town anymore.
Are you considering developing a reservation system for admission to the park?
So we are definitely watching the visitation levels at Canyonlands increasing year over year over year. Arches National Park went through a similar increase over the course of the last decade. Arches National Park visitation has gone up 73%, and it was already on a steady climb more than 10 years ago. So for the last 3 years, Arches has been piloting a timed entry reservation system. Canyonlands visitation level is over half of what Arches is. You know, there are a lot of things a park can do and will do before implementing any kind of direct visitor use management. You know, there are infrastructure changes we will look at if it's appropriate and possible because of the geology, to do appropriate amounts of parking lot expansion or road work or other things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
That's a situation that I think every single public land, not just a national park unit, throughout this region has just been experiencing dramatically increased visitation and trying to figure out how best to manage that.
All right. Well, Karen, I think we need to wrap up on this interview, but we'll talk about wildlife next week in our interview. So thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
So our guest today has been Karen Garthwaite, Acting Public Affairs Specialist for Canyonlands National Park in southeastern Utah. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to kgvm.org or buzzsprout.com and visit our website at js-wilderness.com. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Schell.